But I think it's important that you're going to talk about that and you're going to take the first step, without which you don't take it anyway. But we talk about this lately. There are a great many people that dislike the word alcoholic to such an extent that they deny that it has anything to do with it at all. They're really denying the label. They hate the label. They don't like the word. They don't like the sound of it. They don't like what they think it means, which may not be what it really means at all, but it's what they think it means. And I'd like to tell a story about labeling and what it can mean or not mean to the individual by telling my own case. So for 5 years, I tried to find out what was wrong. 5 very long years. Each year, since alcoholism was a progressive disease, and that was what was wrong with me, although I didn't know it, it got worse. And it was like a spiral going down. It was so bad that fairly early in those 5 years, around the second year, I think, I began to think that I was sick. And I'm sure, I mean, insane, but really insane. I could not reconcile my own behavior with the person I really knew myself to be. I couldn't reconcile the change that had taken place in my drinking with anything. I couldn't understand it, and I used to describe it as something must have broken in my head. I didn't know any of the lingo of psychiatry or mental illness in those days, and so I used words that were descriptive to me, although they might not have meant anything to anybody else. Because I thought I was insane, I went to a number of psychiatrists. Now, it happened that this last 5 years, the 4 of the last 5 years of my drinking was spent in England, where I'd been living for many years before that, before I got into any trouble. So I started trying to find out. I went to my regular doctor, who was an internist, a very well-known one, and said that I thought I was crazy and that I thought I'd better see a psychiatrist. Because that's where you went. You're a head shrinker if there was something wrong with your head. And this was a woman doctor. She was so good and so well known that when she died about 10 or 15 years ago, somebody sent me that it was one of the best English publications with a full page editorial on her death. What she had done and how bad that she'd be missed. And she said, she laughed. She said, "That's just silly. You're not crazy at all. You're suffering from fatigue. You've been working too hard. You've been burning the candle at both ends. I'm sure you've been drinking a lot because all your group do. You knew most of them. And it's a hard drinking too." But she said, "All you need is a good rest and to get away from all of the pressures and responsibilities that you're feeling here in London," which was in London. Well, I didn't feel that I could afford to go away for just a rest. And I didn't see what good that was going to do anyway. But I set about finding something else I might be able to do, and that was to get out of the kind of life I was leading in London, and maybe adopt a different kind of life that would not be so full of pressure, not be so hectic and so frantic. Incidentally, I didn't realize that I was doing the usual thing. I thought this was a brilliantly original idea of my own. Nobody else had ever thought of such a thing. So I took my first geographic tour, which is what we call it in my day. And every alcoholic, most of them anyway, take a certain number of geographic tours before they discover, as I did, that you take yourself with you. Doesn't matter where you go. You are not any different because you're in another county in England, or because you're in another country, or because you're in another state in this country. Very little has changed because your problem is in you. So it doesn't matter where you are. And I discovered that. So things got worse, and I saw some other doctors, and one of them told me I had an anxiety neurosis, and that it was so extreme that I was having a nervous breakdown. That phrase is still widely used in those days, back in the 30s. And what I really needed was 6 to 8 weeks in a good private psychiatric hospital. They called them nursing homes. Well, here was something else that was suggested that I couldn't do. I couldn't afford it. And I had no idea about how to go about it. I had my own business. If I was missing, I wasn't paid. There wasn't much business. And I guess that was the final thing that triggered me into figuring out my own solution. I had some friends that owned a very attractive hotel in a village not too far from Oxford, a picture book village called Broadway. Unlike New York City's Broadway as anything could possibly be. Nothing had been built on their main street since the late 16th, early 17th century. It was a Jacobean, white stucco and black beams, absolutely huge, with just one long main street and a big grass common at the bottom. The people I knew, the two young men that I knew, had bought the house at the foot of the street, facing the common, and added to it and turned it into an inn. And I used to go there, as many of us did, for weekends, although it was quite a long way from London. It was a lovely place to go for weekends. They had also done something else that was unheard of in England in those days. They built a swimming pool in the back of the big ground. They wanted to go to Madeira for the winter, and they were concerned about what would happen to the inn while they were gone, so they said they talked to me about it. They apparently heard me talking about maybe I ought to get out of London. They didn't know how bad my drinking was. They didn't see that much of me. They came into London occasionally. By that time, I had blackouts so much of the time that other people didn't know how badly off I was, and I didn't either. I woke up in the morning and didn't know how I got there, or where I'd been, or what I'd said, or what I'd done in this night before. So I went down at their suggestion to run the inn while they were gone. And some of you may have heard this, who've been here before. I don't know if you had or not there. But I decided not to drink. I thought I'd quit for a while. This was in the winter, the beginning of Lent, and I thought, well, I'll just stop drinking for Lent. And I'm sure I'll feel better. So I stopped. First time I ever had. No trouble, I stopped. But the next day, I was terribly sick. I'd had chills, I'd had sweat, I was shaking like a leaf, I couldn't eat, I couldn't keep anything down. I scared me to death, so I called the local doctor, who was a GP, and told him how I felt, and he took my temperature, and he looked at me carefully, and he listened to my test, and he said, you've just come down here from London, haven't you? I said, yes. He said, you know, I think you may have picked up some tropical disease. I don't know what it is yet. I'd just like you to stay in bed and keep well covered and drink a lot of liquid. We'll see how you are tomorrow. Well, tomorrow I was better. The third day I was fine. And that little doctor was the proudest doctor in England because he had cured an unknown tropical disease. He didn't know what withdrawal from alcohol was, nor did I. I had never had it before because I had never stopped before. Want some way up here, Henry, or take care of that?
Sorry, you didn't bother us.
That's all right, dear. At any rate, I didn't last all of Lent. I lasted for a couple of weeks or 3 months. And then I was right back drinking. With one difference, I had decided to only drink beer. I happened to like beer. Now, there were two things about this inn that I was running. One was it had no license, so that the guests that stayed any length of time, even for a weekend, brought their own bottles and they were set up in the dining room and sideboard for them. And the butler, who was the absolutely perfect stereotype of a butler, you couldn't believe he was real, he was so perfect, but he was a very nice, rather elderly gentleman, would go across the street to a pub and bring back trays of what guests ordered. But there was no liquor served in the hotel. You had it there of your own. And I decided two things. One was that I wasn't going to keep any liquor in my room. I knew what would happen. I had arrived at the point where I'd have enough when I went to bed to hold me for the morning, to get me out of bed. But when I woke up in the morning, the bottle was empty. And I didn't know I'd done it. I got nothing out of that, except it was gone. I didn't dare keep it in my room. I felt worse than I would as if I hadn't had it, and I didn't have it there to get me out of bed and get me out of the hangover. So I didn't care for that. And I had begun to think of an arrangement with a butler whereby I could get drinks when I needed them, but I didn't want to do that. I was going to stay on, since I hadn't stayed entirely on the wagon, I was going to just stay on beer for the rest of it. And there was a pub across the common, which was very visible to get to, at least you were visible getting to it. But around the corner, there was a pub that could be reached through the orchard in back of the hotel. Back door, back door. And my office had a door leading out to the back. The guests didn't necessarily know when I was, whether I was in my office or not. There weren't that many. They weren't coming every minute just to get something for me. So I would go out the back door and go across the orchard to this little pub. Now, oddly enough, this is a strange little pub. It only served beer. It wasn't licensed or anything else. And I had been there drinking beer any number of nights. They'd gotten to know me quite well. And one of them said, "Have you ever tried old beer?" I said, "What's old beer?" "Why, aged in the keg," they said. I said, "Good Lord, is it strong?" "Oh, it's at least 80%. So I drank old beer. That was my beer wagon. You could get just as drunk on the same amount of old beer as if you were drinking whiskey, which had been my drink. It was a very strong drink. This is in Worcestershire, incidentally, in the Cotswolds. If you're ever there, try the old beer. I talked to the guests, not to the patients. It's delicious. It's very smooth and very good. So my geographic tour didn't work, because from the beer I was very quickly back onto the hard stuff, and there wasn't that much difference. And I pretty much gave up trying. That was my one effort, and it hadn't worked. But, as inevitably happens with people like us, it got worse and worse and worse, and the owners came home, and they really talked to me like Dutch uncles. They wanted to know what I'd been doing, and what had I been up to, and what was the matter with me, and so on. And I didn't know what was the matter with me. I could answer that question. Sure, I was drinking a lot, but I'd been drinking a lot ever since they'd known me. But I didn't realize it was that much worse every month, actually. And the time came when I had to leave there, because I really couldn't function anymore. And I went back to London and I saw a few more doctors. And I told them how terrible it had become, and I didn't know what to do, and I couldn't seem to do anything about it. And I really thought I was insane, and they said, "Nonsense, you're no such thing. Now, you just settle down and try. You know, limit yourself to two or three." There's some doctors still saying that statement. Limit yourself to two or three. The one thing that is totally and completely impossible for an alcoholic is to limit yourself to two or three. You can stop altogether. Or you can drink all out. But you cannot do controlled drinking for any length of time. I've known some people that have managed to do it for many months. But in the end, there was a blow-up, end-all blow-up. It didn't really work. And I still wasn't getting any answers to why, what had happened, what had gone wrong with my drinking. Nobody could tell me. None of my friends knew. The doctors I went to didn't know. And I had finally reached a point of desperation where I decided it might have something to do with my being an exile. Here I was living in a foreign country. I'd been living there for 7 years, and I'd never gone home. And maybe I'd lost my roots, and maybe what I needed was to go back to the United States and refine myself as an American, and that's what I tried to do, and eventually that's what I did. And of course, I had all kinds of dreams and thoughts and hopes about the stage, which is the second geographic tour. I wasn't going to drink on the boat going over. There weren't any planes then. I was going to do all sorts of things when I got back to the States. I had lots of plans for myself. Well, it turned out that some very good friends of mine poured me on the boat, and I didn't cross over that the whole way across the Atlantic. I never saw the skyline in New York. I never saw the Statue of Liberty. My sister was there to meet me with a friend of hers, and they waited and waited and waited, and I was the last person off the boat, and I was carried. I didn't know I'd arrived. That's what happens to you no matter what promises you make to yourself. Now, mind you, I wasn't promising anyone else. It wasn't anybody I had to promise. I was only promising myself. And when you find you can't keep the promise that you have privately made to yourself, you are really safe. And I was safe. And I didn't, yes, I did. I was sober once for 2 weeks in the following year in New York. It didn't last any longer than that because I got a check from my father and I had to sign it. And I very carefully did it at home. I didn't have a bank account. I had a friend of mine had introduced me to the manager of her bank, and he would cash checks for me. So I carefully made my signature. I hadn't had a drink in exactly 2 weeks, just because I'd been so sick. I thought I'd better lay off a little. And I took the check in, and they said, well, we're sorry, but you'll have to make that signature in front of us. I made 8 signatures. No 2 of them looked like any of the others. None of them looked like mine. And they wouldn't cash the check. And I had little money left in my pocketbook, so out I went, and I took a car, and I had 3 double martinis, and I went back to make a signature. And that is the last time I stopped drinking until I finally stopped. It wasn't worth it. It didn't pay off. You didn't gain anything by it. And I didn't dare. Very scary. That last year of my drinking was more scary than I could possibly tell you. All it did was convince me more and more firmly that indeed I was insane, that it was a terrible kind of insanity I had. In the course of that winter, I saw 8 different psychiatrists. I would tell them how I felt and why I thought that, and I found them all through people I knew. They were highly qualified. They actually turned out to be very honest gentlemen of high integrity who wouldn't take me on because many of them whom I knew later told me they didn't know what in hell to do with people like you. And they didn't. This was 1937-38. The 8th one, and I won't go into the details, excepting that I literally didn't draw a sober drink. I couldn't stand being sober, because as soon as the liquor began to wear off, I could see what was happening, and that was so frightening. So I started to drink again to drown it out. And the great Dr. Jelinek, who was the great scientific authority in this field, when he did his first chart on the progression of alcoholism, he got to a certain point, and he's been going up and down. He did it first on a blackboard, but now exists in print. Up and down like this, there's down parts being drunk, and those getting closer and closer together. And then there comes a point when, instead of up and down like this, it goes this way. The vicious way. When you're drinking because of your drinking, is how he described it. So that's the way I was. I was drinking because of my drinking. The drinking made me feel so awful that only drinking would make me forget how awful I felt, and a little while would make me feel a little better. I still had no clue of what was wrong. I still was convinced that I was hopelessly insane, and the more the doctors that I went to told me I wasn't, the more I thought, well, it's something so awful they can't even tell me. Now, I came to this conclusion because I forced one or two of them
to at least give me advice. If they wouldn't take me on, what could I do? More than one or two, five or six, I think, anyway. They all said the same thing. I was close. You'll have to commit yourself to a state mental hospital. To me, that meant lunacy. It meant more than that. It meant snake pit. The little I knew about state hospitals for the insane, asylums, the more frightening they sounded. And I would always ask the same question, for how long? And I got one of two answers. They either completely evaded it and didn't say anything, or in one case only, the doctor said, indefinite. And then I knew that I was indeed hopelessly insane. It was so bad, if I ever went in there, I'd never get out. So guess what I did? Every time I had that sentence passed on me, I left that doctor's office, went to the nearest bar, and drank as many drinks as I could get down, or as I could buy, which I had in my pocket. To forget what he said. This went on for a whole year. And finally, the eighth one, and this is Christmas present, I've been given an appointment with this man, didn't do this. He also said that I was not insane, but he said, I have to tell you something. He said, people like you, in my experience, have one chance in 100. If you want to get well so badly, I'm going to take a chance on your being that one. I'm going to take it. And he did it with me. And that was the beginning of my recovery. That year, under his immediate care, and the following year in a private psychiatric hospital in Greenwich, I was under intensive psychiatric care. I learned an awful lot about myself. But you know what all those doctors called me? People like you. I had no meaning, whatever was wrong. And the sanitarium I was in was set up a little differently from this. It was a great, big, beautiful estate in Greenwich and had buildings all over, just like this one does. But they were arranged in a funny way. When you first came in, you went to the intensive care house, which happens sometimes here. And very often you saw people coming in straitjackets in the ambulance, taken out of the ambulance. There was another little house right down near the gate for the really violent ones, and we had to walk by that on our way to the recreation building. And there was a little nine-hole golf course passed down that way, and you hear them screaming in the street. So plenty of people came in there very, very sick indeed. Then there was a temporary house people that were not violent but were still too sick to go to the main house, the regular house, might be kept for 2 or 3 weeks or months. And then there was a house where most came. It was sort of the middle ground. And that's where I was right away, because I was first to focus, and I didn't have to go to either of the other places, and I wasn't screaming, and I wasn't in the face of it. So I was in the middle house. Month after month after month after month. And I would see people that I had seen come in straitjackets in an ambulance and go either to that house down to the golf course where they had padded cells and they screamed, or go into the what today they call intensive care house, come to the middle house where I was, graduate to the graduate house, which would be at like our main house here, that's where the doctor's office is, and go home. But me? I say, And what was I? People like you. My psychiatrist, who really helped me enormously, used to say in later years that I had been the victim of his ignorance. And I used to say, may you have many such victims, because I got well. And I wouldn't have without him. But I was the victim of his ignorance. He never mentioned alcoholism. I doubted he knew very much about it. He knew, just as the other doctor did, that people like you have hardly a chance, because we don't know what to do with people. It's what they were really saying. All the same, he tried, and I think for the same reason that the first doctor who took me on, Dr. Kennedy, because I wanted to get well so badly. I was almost over motivated by that. I really had it. I couldn't take it anymore. I either had to get well or die. There was nothing else. But all the same, they still didn't know what to do for people like me. Now, I had been under the second doctor, who was the medical director of the psychiatric hospital, Dr. Tebow's care, for nearly a year. When he sent for me one day, and he was homesick. And so I was taken down to his home in Greenwich. On his bed, there was a funny-looking book lying open. It wasn't a book. It looked like typed pages put together with a wire surface thing and a red cardboard cover. It was open, but I could see the red cardboard cover. And he said, I have been reading a book. And he said, it was written by a group of people like you, and they seem to have found an answer. And he said, I hope, I feel that maybe this will work for you, and I want you to take this book and read it. And I took it, and I opened it, and I saw that the title was Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, that, to me, was the funniest title I'd ever heard. I didn't know this word, alcohol. I had never heard it. Now, that wasn't surprising in the 30s. Almost nobody had ever heard that word. I started reading that book avidly. And in the beginning of the book, I found a full description of what it was that was wrong, and I could fit me. And they said, this condition is called alcoholism, and it's a disease, and it is not curable. And they went on to say why. They called it, and scientifically the word allergy is inaccurate, but what they meant was a difference of some kind. That word was in popular use at that time. There was a movie called Allergic to Love. You know, it was not a scientific, technical word to many people. They said that alcoholism was an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. They added that nobody knew what this bodily difference was. It was totally unknown. Therefore, nobody knew what to do about it. So it was probably irreversible. It certainly was at that time in history, and it still is. Because you had this irreversible bodily condition, you could never safely put alcohol in that body again. The body couldn't handle it the way it should, the way it used to. See, I could recognize you. This is what's been causing me. I knew my body couldn't handle it anymore. After 10 years of handling it better than anybody, that's an awful thing to happen to you when you lose that. But they went on to say that the only answer to this bodily difference was never to put alcohol in your particular body. However, then you have the obsession of the mind that drives you to drink very often when you don't tend to, you don't want to. You've made pledges and plans and promises and everything else that you're not going to, and yet you do all the same. They call this the obsession of the mind. And they said in the book that they felt they had found some answers to this obsession of mind, which would help you not to put alcohol in your body that couldn't handle it. And you know, that was the first thing that I had heard that made any sense at all. I was an alcoholic and I had the disease about it. Perfectly clear. But far from resenting the label, or feeling that I didn't want to accept it and I didn't want to be called it, I was so happy to have a name, I was ready to go screaming down the street, hey, I'm an alcoholic. You can't imagine how much better that is than to have an unknown insanity, which so bad you're going to have to be locked up forever. It's far better to have a label, I tell you. Well, the reason I'm telling you this is because I've always found it very difficult to understand people who so resent the word alcoholic and find it so hard to accept and to use about themselves. There's a second thing I must say to you about it. It's not a slang term. I knew all the slang terms, because they were all about men. They had nothing to do with me. But I knew about drunks and drunkards and lushers and spouses and a few other things you could mention. None of them very pretty terms. Those were the only words I knew for people who drank tea. People who were drunk. The word alcoholism and its companion word alcoholism were coined by a Swedish scientist, and his name was Magnus Foot, H-U-S-S, in 1848, because he felt that there were nothing but adjectives to describe. He was studying in this area. He was studying alcoholism and alcoholics, but in those days they called it chronic or continual drunkenness. And alcoholics were called drunkards, and that was the end. And he didn't like those terms. He didn't feel those were scientific. So he coined the word alcoholism for the condition and alcoholic for the victim. And they're still in scientific terms and nothing to get upset about or excited about. If you had thought for a long while that you had something a lot worse than that, you'd be glad to take it too. And there are, I think, a certain number of alcoholics who had that same fear that I had. If they've gone far enough, they begin to think they must have changed. And they begin to be convinced that they've changed. At any rate, I didn't mean to give you such a big historical background, but I wanted to explain to you why I find alcoholic a very pleasant word. I have no objection to it. And actually, I'm proud to be an alcoholic since I'm not drinking. There's nothing wrong with being an alcoholic if you're not drunk. And it's easy not to be drunk if you don't drink at all. So I have no quarrel with the word alcoholic. And I think the word alcoholism is a perfectly good word for the disease that we all have. However, I've had to do an awful lot of reading in the last 2 weeks in preparation for a meeting in Washington next Monday and Tuesday. What I've been reading have been grant applications for funds from the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. And there are in many different areas, a whole lot of research applications and their training applications and their treatment applications. There are industrial alcoholism, they call it occupational alcoholism, and Indians, and a whole lot of different things. And now, the second time last night, I came across a new word. Last week, when I started reading these, I read a very scholarly application for research money, which was entirely about Jelinek's disease. They were going to study Jelinek. Well, maybe that's what we'll all be. I don't know what they'll call us. Jelinekers? Jelinekers? But there it was, in print. Very serious, and this is an application written by scientists, and apparently they're calling it government. So last night, I'm still working away at this staff. It's about that high. I have to read before it's Sunday when I go to Washington. I read another application, and it was talking about ethanolism. They're studying ethanolism. Maybe we're not going to have the word alcoholism around much longer. Maybe they're going to come up with something entirely different. I suppose he's the ethanolist. You know, if you think about that a little bit, you'll see what I mean. That the words we use and we have that we are not the best. These are people who don't like the word either. But they're scientists. And they'd like to get away from it. And I know one group that would love to get away, and those are the distillers. Because the two words that were coined by the Swedish scientist, who wasn't thinking in terms of profit-making distillers, both have alcohol in them. So they don't like it. They coined the term problem drinking and problem drinking to avoid the word alcohol. But I think there's a lot to be said about facing what you really are and becoming able to face it without quivering, without shaking, without stumbling, because you no longer feel badly about it. You have a right to feel badly if you're drunk, and you'll certainly feel badly if you're just coming off a drink. But if you're sober, there's no reason why you should have any feelings. I don't know if any of you are diabetic, but I've never heard a diabetic hesitate to call himself a diabetic. They don't accept you. And yet they're in the same boat we are, only theirs is the sugar, but ours is alcohol. All of this is leading up to the fact that if you want to get well, you have to tackle it at its root, at the base. You have to accept the fact that you are an alcoholic, that you have the disease of alcoholism, and the cancer. Now, if you're an alcoholic, that's an awful lot of cancer. It's a great big bite. And I know many people that have been unable to do it. I know some that have been back here any number of times that they haven't been able to do it. But they're still trying, and they still come back, and one of these days they will do it. They'll have it made. And I admire people who are willing to try again. If they don't make it the first time, they don't have to then jump out of window and put their throat. This is a chronic condition. And having relapses is really almost part of it. A lot of people that don't have them, but more who do. It's not the end of the world if you have that, but you have less chance of having relapses, I think. If you have gained a very deep-seated inner conviction about what it is that's wrong with you and what that makes you and what it means that you have to do. That is step one, in other words. And without step one, you aren't going anywhere. You see, the least they do to work on the others if you have to take them out.
Well, how long do you recommend taking the interview? 2 years, 3 years?
I wouldn't put any time on it at all. I think that entirely depends on the individual. I've known people that have been on it for 6 months when they first stopped drinking, and then they just forgot all about it and sailed along and had no trouble. I happen to have two friends that have been on it 25 and 26 years, respectively. And when I ask them why on earth, because they're both active in AA, they both give the same answer. Look, it's my insurance. And I don't think anything about it. I do it like I brush my teeth. Automatic part of my getting up in the morning. You have to take care of in the morning. And if it makes them feel comfortable, why not? It's never shown that it's done anybody any harm.
What is it? I mean, I know what cannabis is as such, what it looks like, and what its purpose is, and what it affects biology and strength and entertainment. But what is it really? I mean, what kind of a chemical or a drug? Everybody says it does the system no harm.
It doesn't. It's a drug that increases something called acetaldehyde. It blocks it, so it can't pass through your body the way it normally does. And if you have a lot of acetaldehyde, alcohol will upset it very much. And you have some very definite reactions if you put alcohol in your body while cannabis is in. It isn't bile and vomiting, which most people think of when you say you're very sick. Cannabis patients turn that red from here up. It's called a blushing. It's the deepest blush you ever saw. Their heart beats very fast. They have trouble getting their breath. They tell me, people that have had it, that it's like impending disaster. They wish they died. Sometimes they also vomit, but not always. This passes in due course. If you take ad abuse and don't put alcohol in your body, you might as well take a sugar pill. Nothing.
Is anybody allergic to
I've never heard of it. I suppose somebody will turn up someday, but I've never heard of it.
You just turn red, that's all?
Only if you drink.
I mean, if you drink, that's all you turn red?
But let me tell you another thing. One of the great advantages, you see, most of us are impulsive drinkers. And you'll hear again and again, if you go to AA meetings, you'll hear somebody describing having had a slip and how they didn't know they were going into the bar or over to the cupboard where the liquor's kept. They did it in a kind of a blind move, automatic, real automatism. And they didn't realize it till they had the drink half down their throat. And you'll hear this over and over again. It's true. It happened to me. I know it's true. What happens if you have ad abuse in your system? That doesn't. You're terribly aware from the moment you take it, whether it's night or morning, that you have something in your body that means if you drink, you're going to be very sick. Now, the interesting thing about ad abuse is that if you get it in your body, it doesn't leave it quickly. You have to stop taking it and wait 5 days before you can take a drink without that reaction. You see what it does to impulsive drinking? You have 5 days to think about it. And I know lots of people that plan to drunk, stop taking their ad abuse, and by about the third day, they say, God, what's the matter with me? I don't want to do that. And they went right back in the end. It gives you time to think.
Well, why is it necessary to take the ad abuse every day if the reaction?
Because you keep that level built up to a certain point. In fact, you start with a bigger dose. You start with a full tablet every day for 4 days. Mm-hmm. Some doctors say 5 days. Mm-hmm. Then you go on half a tablet. And that's your maintenance dose for as long as you take it. Though my two friends that have taken it for 25 and 26 years take a half a tablet every other day.
Yeah.
It's just sort of keeping it going so that...
Well, I guess it's like a security blanket, really.
It is like a security blanket. Exactly right. I have a doctor friend who's an alcoholic and who's been sober 21 or 22 years, who doesn't take it regularly, but keeps it in her medicine chest. And if she's got problems, and she has a very tough job, if she is coming up to a period that she knows is going to be full of problems and very upsetting, she takes the antabuse until the period's passed, and then she gets the money until the next time. And that's a very good security blanket.
Would you just take a maintenance dose in a case like that?
Yes. Well, if you hadn't taken it for 4 or 5 years, it probably would be wise to take the full tablet for 4 or 5 days. Most doctors say 4 days and then a half. Yes, Henry.
Lottie, that you just said about a friend of yours taking antabuse for that long on a daily basis. It seems to me that you could just have a hell of a lot of other problems. If you stop that antabuse,
the two people I'm talking about are both men. One 25 years, one 26.
Well, sex is a problem. It's just a length of time.
Well, I was flabbergasted too. That's why I said, what on earth are you doing that for? Because both these men are still active in AA after all that time. I didn't see why they needed it. But they said they felt it was insurance and they felt more comfortable taking it. So if that's what it means to them, okay.
Well, they must be very insecure, weak people.
No, they're not. You know very well who one of them was. He's not either insecure or weak, at least in the world's eyes.
Why don't they mention antabuse at more these AA meetings? I don't mean here, but I can know a lot of
because AA was going a long while before antabuse was discovered.
How long ago you told us the other
day? It was discovered in 1949. And became available in this country in 1950. Most of the people that took it in the beginning were people who had not been able to make it in AA. They couldn't stay so. And many AAs felt that they were just reaching for a crutch and that AA should be enough. And many of them still feel it. But for everybody, it isn't enough. Some people need an extra crutch. And my argument is if you break a leg, you use a crutch. And why not this? And actually, if you want to get right down to it, what is AA if not a crutch?
Positive.
So why quibble about another one? Some people have such a bad break, they need two crutches. Others need a wheelchair. I don't know what that would be. Staying here indefinitely, I guess.
It must be your family in Al-Anon.
Maybe. Incidentally, that is an enormous help to the alcoholic, if they can get their families to go to home. They'll learn a lot more and learn it a lot more faster, and their behavior will change toward that alcoholic very much. It's a good thing to try for. And this is also true if you have children. If they're in their teens, get them to Alateen. All of these things will make it easier for them. It'll make it easier for them, too. If my concern is the alcoholic, it'll certainly make it easier if their families are learning a great deal about it and trying to do something about their part in the picture, which sometimes is very big. Not that they know it. The whole problem is his drinking. If he just stopped drinking, there wouldn't be any problem. Well, that's just not true. Stopping drinking is only the beginning of the solution to the problem. In itself, it is not the total solution. You have to do something about yourself, you have to do something about your lifestyle, about your life, about the way you do things, and what you do and don't do. You have to do something about everything, really. You can't just stop drinking. If you just stop drinking, you are not, in my opinion, recovered. You're just dry. And I don't see that. But for me, at least, that wouldn't have been enough. I wouldn't have stayed dry, if that's all. I had to do a whole lot more about myself than just stop drinking. And so the most. You here, I think, are very lucky because you've got expert help in doing something about the other problems, which exist. And incidentally, I was talking to one of the doctors at lunch today, and she said something that made me respond, and I said, you know, I don't think for a minute that all alcoholics had severe neurotic problems. or psychological problems before they drank. Some do, I know. But many. Well, she said, oh, no, I didn't mean that. She said, I don't know which came first. I said, well, that's the point. It's like the chicken and the egg. If you had no problems, psychological problems of any kind, and you drank enough to be alcoholic, boy, you'd develop them. You'd get every neurosis in the book. Alcoholism makes you that. Gives you anxieties, fears, and words. I shouldn't have to tell you. You've all had them. Well, there's another thing, which is that in many people whose neurotic tendencies or their psychological quirks are the result of their alcoholism, very often stopping drinking is the major thing they need to do, because the other things, if they're not nourished with alcohol, will go away. And that's why a lot of people do very well in AA without anything else. If they're that type, and they stick to it, most of their problems will be resolved. But it's much easier and quicker to get some expert help and get them resolved before you try living without drinking, which is hard enough anyway. I don't think it's easy. It becomes easy after a long while, but it isn't easy. The first year is the hardest, as we've always heard about everything. And the first year is when you need all the support you can get and all the help you can get.
Give your book a further boost, Marty, and to go back to a comment that Harriet made to us last week at a film, asking how many of us were here under pressure, be it pressure from our families, pressure from ourselves, whatever the case may be, something pressured us into coming here to stop drinking. And with that same, with the problems that I've been having maritally, and that last week everything kind of blew up and everybody here was telling Sal that he wasn't accepting alcoholism as a disease.
He became
violently furious with everyone here. Sick and tired of hearing it. And I said, well, have you read Marty's book yet? It's been sitting on the desk for 4 weeks. He hasn't time.
Of course not.
But suddenly he had 3 days of time to read your whole book.
No kidding.
And last weekend was just full of understanding and questions, and he has your book highlighted to a...
Well, that's wonderful.
He's read it the whole
thing. It really worked.
It was that, the combination of that and our first four-way meeting was what did it.
Well, that makes me feel very good. Mm-hmm. That's the purpose.
But it had to be pressure.
It had to be pressure. Well,
however,
you know, they like to say in AA, and I've been around longer than most people, that they can't help you until you come asking for help. And that you have to be ready. And I don't believe that. I think intervention is possible. And I don't think any AAs, including me at the beginning, ever went really voluntarily. There's no such thing. You just finished saying it. There's pressure of one sort or another. Now, even if it's only the basic pressure of arriving at the point where the pain outweighs the pleasure, that's pressure. You're doing it to get away from something. You're doing it to stop hurting. You're not voluntarily going because it's a lovely thing. You're going because you hurt so much, you've got to do something. And an awful lot of people get to AA because their wives threaten divorce, their boss threatened firing. The most successful programs that we have, and I'm talking about the National Council, are our industrial programs. Our employee alcoholism program. They are getting 70, 75, 80% recovery. Now, there are two reasons for this. One, it's a selected population. They're all working. And most of them, by the time they developed alcoholism, have been with that company quite a while, at whatever level they work. Secondly, they are motivated to go and get help because their immediate superior, whoever it is, tells them that they have an opportunity to get help, and if they don't accept it and their work performance continues to go down, they're out. So they have threat of job. That's a powerful motivating tool. Now that's pressure, but the successes are fantastic. They did a study of court cases where they had the choice of going to jail for 90 days or going to AA.
This is
quite some time. And they got a very high rate of recovery because most of them chose going to AA. They didn't want to go to jail for 90 days. And if they were exposed for 90 days, a sizable proportion of them, not 70 to 80, but maybe 20 to 30% stayed sober. Stayed with AA and stayed sober. So pressure works. But my point is that I think there's always pressure of whatever nature. See, one problem that we all have is that the very nature of alcoholism is to create blindness in us. The progression is very slow and subtle. And most of us, in our early years of drinking, were terrific drinkers. We drank very well. We carried our liquor like a man or a lady. And everybody thought we were wonderful, and so did we. And we drank a great deal over quite a long period without having any trouble at all. Again, there are many exceptions to this, but this is a pretty broad pattern. What we remember is the fun we had before we began having fun. And it's very, very hard for us to accept that we can't get back. So we go on kidding ourselves and thinking, well, I know what it was. I didn't have any dinner that night. I know what it was. My boss was an SOB and I had a terrible day at the office. I know what it was. My wife is a chronic nag and she's got to the point where I can't stay in the house with her. All these specific reasons are why he got drunk again. But that isn't why he got drunk. He got drunk again that night because he's an alcoholic. These things trigger, but they're not the cause of them.
That is absolutely essential to give you a base to stand on. And I'll read it to you. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. But I finally saw that step. I had no problem admitting that at all. My life, God knows, has been unmanageable for nearly 5 years. But today, and this is 35 years later, today there are a great many people coming for help to a place like this, or directly to AA, or to many other treatment facilities, who are in the early stages of their alcoholism. They're alcoholics, often, but they haven't progressed very far. For such people, it is more difficult than it was for me to say that I am powerless over alcohol and my life has become unmanageable. And some of them don't feel that their lives have become unmanageable. Now, I would guess that any one of you, if you wanted to really be honest about it, and if you wanted to really think it through, would not be able to deny that while you were drinking alcoholically, to excess, a lot, you are not in charge of your life. You couldn't be. You couldn't follow through on things that you said you were going to do. All I have to do is look back at the fact that I broke promises I made to no one in the world but me. Nobody else even knew I'd made them. I made decisions about how much I was going to drink next time, where I was going to stop, what my limit was going to be. And I never once could live up to that. And that was the only decision, the first time in my whole life, that I'd made decisions I couldn't keep. That's why I thought I was insane. But the real truth of it was, I was not insane, but my life had become unmanageable. I couldn't plan. I couldn't say I'll do this and I won't do that with any certainty. And that is a very frightening situation to be in. And I don't believe that it's possible to recover from anything as complex and as difficult as alcoholism is if you don't make that deep inner change which accepts that first step so that your acceptance of it is automatic. It's simply part of you. It becomes part of you. And until you've achieved that, you're not safe. That is the beginning. That's where you start. And if you can do that, then you can go anywhere. Sky's the limit. And that's all I'm trying to do. You can ask me any questions you like. The first step. Very simple title. I got tired of my old fancy title. Tell me I've talked to the old best dumb and blind. Yes.
Martin, you know something that happened to me. After I had stopped drinking, I knew I was an alcoholic and was going to meetings constantly. My kids were very upset because at school, the junior high, the word is spread through a wildfire and it's talking to an alcoholic. And this letter, I love these kids for that.
Yeah, you know, but it's understandable, Dale. I really do think.
Yeah.
See, what you were upset by was the ignorance that is still so prevalent about this whole thing. People don't know what the word alcoholic means, and far too many of them still, after 30 years of the kind of work that my organization has been doing and that I've been doing, still picture the alcoholic as a Skid Row bum.
Yeah.
And that's never a woman did.
Yeah.
Skid Row bums are male.
This upset my 17-year-old. But I should have reacted differently.
Well, that's expecting an awful lot. How long have you been sober? Small wonder that you didn't react as well as you might have. You hadn't been sober long enough to develop any kind of resilience about a thing like that, you know, and flexibility about it. And I've said this in different ways on many occasions, but we're all going to face things like that. Everybody who goes out to face things, because they're everywhere, they're around. A simple thing like a friend of mine from Mexico City who got into AA while her husband was stationed in Washington during the war, and then after the war they went back to Mexico City. And her sister-in-law, who was a bitch, I might tell you, when I met her, I knew exactly what happened and why and how. She gave a welcoming home party for Pauline. And everybody was there, and when the servant came in with a tray of drinks, she turned and said in a loud voice so everybody could hear it, "The pineapple juice on the end is yours, Pauline." Pauline got drunk. I don't blame her. Would have been me, I think I would have. But these are very hard things you have to bear. This is awfully hard on the person you have to bear. I think it's even harder for a man to have a hostess tell him what he can drink. This is yours. I've got ginger ale for you. People do very stupid things, and I think some of them are sheer ignorance. They don't know any better, and some of them are sheer malice.
Jason, I wasn't drinking that. Certain friends I would go to
dinner,
I resented very much.
Because of the way they handled it.
There would be two wine glasses in front of each place, but no wine glasses in front of my
place.
Yeah. That's what I mean.
I think it's very wrong.
This is exactly what I mean. It's rude.
It's bad manners.
That's what I say. It's rude.
It's
well, it's amazing how many people have no manners, Henry.
Well, there won't be a lot of business.
And the other thing I would like to ask you, for a lengthy period when I didn't drink, I simply would say, I don't drink. I just commonly say that. A lot of people don't drink. I have a brother who was an alcoholic. He doesn't drink. He never had a drink until he was 40 years old, and that's because his doctor wanted him to start having one cocktail a day. It was because his brother's in a little party outside.
Otherwise, he wouldn't have had that.
And he wouldn't have had that, and he still doesn't want it. But at any rate, I was simply saying, I don't drink, I haven't been drinking. Should I add, I don't drink because I'm an alcoholic?
No, not at all.
I thought that's what you were saying.
No, that isn't what I'm saying. I'm talking about inside your own self, you know. Not at all. As a matter of fact, George, I think it's very interesting the way people handle it. There are all kinds of ways. I've got a second book that I think you'll like because I've done a chapter on ways to handle that situation. It's called Questions and Answers about Drinking and Alcoholism. But I have said that for some people, the best thing and the most convenient thing and that shuts them up, the person says, I can't drink all doctor's orders. You say why?
Yes.
Could be a lot of reasons. They could have ulcers, God knows what they could have, but I can't drink doctor's orders. That stops it right away. But frankly, I have a feeling that you succeeded without difficulty because you said it with conviction. And frankly, if you say it in the right tone of voice and you really mean it, people leave you alone.
Yes.
But funnily enough, there are a lot of people who have just stopped drinking. And they say, no, thank you, I'm not drinking. And they say it in such a way they're inviting somebody to push it on them so that they can give up. And you know, that is instinctively known. So that if your answer isn't strong enough in tone and feeling and so on, they'll push it on you. And that's very often. And I know because I've had it pushed on me when I really was thinking of how much I'd like to have. It gets into your voice.
Yeah.
And that's what they heard. And the only people that I talked about why I didn't drink were people that were very good friends of mine. And I did that right away because I wanted to close all possible doors to myself. If I told them I was an alcoholic and couldn't drink, and they didn't know what that meant till I explained it, then I wouldn't have the nerve to drink at their house or in front of them after telling them all this. So it was a measure of self-protection. But that didn't apply to just general people. I was talking about close friends that I saw up. The only ones that I explained to. And I did it because I wanted to, because it was, I felt safer for me. But I think it's not required of anybody to say that to anybody unless they choose to. And secondly, unless you're asked a direct question that traps you, I just don't think there's any need. Now, if you're asked a direct question, it may be simpler to tell them the truth, you know, and tell them off. A couple of times when I've been in that position, I said, well, I don't drink because I'm an alcoholic, and if I took that one drink, you wouldn't like me here in a few hours. And you wouldn't be getting rid of me either. I'd be here. But that was my feeling. You know, I wanted to slap them with that, and that's why I did it. But there's no necessity for it. You don't have to do it. The only place where you're expected to say I'm an alcoholic is in an AA meeting. If you're sick of it.
How do you feel?
Comes up. We discussed it, a couple of us were discussing this the other day. Is on applications for things. I remember when I was in the service, there were all these disagreeable things that we've been treated for epilepsy, heart trouble, so on and so forth. And one of the things is usually alcohol, was on that forum, and it's on applications for driver's licenses, that kind of thing. Have you ever been treated for alcoholism?
That's new since my day, thank God. I've had my driver's license for a long time.
Yeah.
Then you're not likely not to get it.
You're not to get it, yeah.
But you've been treated for alcoholism, didn't you?
It should be a pro rather than a minus. That's not the reason the question is there.
No, and there's some effort going on to change that at the government level, because they think that's unfair. You shouldn't be penalized for something you've gotten over, for God's sake. You know. Same thing about a hunting license, Jimmy.
Can't get a hunting license.
You need to walk in.
I've never been aware of this place to rest.
Well, one of the earliest questions that the members wrestled with is, mm-hmm. what do you tell a prospective employer? How far do you go? And the general feeling always was that nobody could tell anybody else what to tell, but we felt that you were not to say anything unless you were forced to. In other words, if there was a specific question, are you an alcoholic, or have you been treated for alcoholism, it's dangerous to lie because they might find out. So you're laying up trouble for yourself. You know, you could lie awake nights wondering if they found out yet.
But if I needed a job and saved my children, I would lie on a questionnaire that they had used.
And people have, and it didn't get them drunk.
I'm talking about me and Kansas. You know, I would lie to me.
Well, I think alcoholics, many of them would and have.
I recommend lying. I just lost my flying license because I checked that thing here.
I know that.
And I've lied. I wish I hadn't said it.
You think you're going to get it back?
No, I think so. I never have had a wreck. I never have flown intoxicated.
I hope you do get it back.
Yeah.
There's a doctor in New York that flies his own plane. He's one of the best known men in this field, Stanley Gitlow. Maybe he'd write something to help you.
Well, I've got a letter now that I've got to take to Dr. Marcus.
Well, I don't take it to him today.
No.
You haven't been back long enough, and you haven't been without a drink long enough. I think he might be a little afraid of.
I couldn't see the connection, though, because you're getting married.
I'd like to make it seem lost. But do you know something, Mark? Do you know why that happened? Well, it's about 6-7 years ago, I think, that they were making a lot of studies about alcohol and accidents. And they found out that some very high percentage, like 60 or 65% of private plane accidents, the person piloting the plane had better than 0.15 alcohol.
Right, that's right. And you know who has what profession has the highest number of that? Doctors.
Doctors. Uh-huh. They have one of the highest rates of alcoholism, too.
Because they feel like they've got to get there no matter what the weather is or no matter what, so they're flying to the mountain.
Yeah.
And they're not as smart flying airplanes as they are in the profession, probably. Well, I wish I'd checked his nose.
I don't blame you.
How many of those are audited? If you had, I wonder what's the percentage of your income tax?
None of them would be audited. It's the only thing, probably, if I had had an accident, and I was worried about the insurance.
Yes, sure.
That's the only thing that I can. None of them are audited.
I think lilac hell, like a gentleman and a lady, and after all.
Well, you can lie on
a life insurance policy,
and if it's 2 years old, it doesn't make any. They can't renege on you.
I think we have to behave in ways that we have to behave because of public attitudes and attitudes to certain groups, whether it's insurance carriers or people who give out licenses for hunting or driving or flying or whatever. They are way behind the times. These things are ridiculous. And until we get those changed, this is just my personal feeling. I think we have a perfect right to do whatever we can to see that we get whatever it is, if we need a driving license, or if we want a hunting license.
If you hadn't had a drink in 25 years, you still have to check. You've been treated for alcoholism.
That is quite true. And
then they
right.
don't care. They don't know that they're not you.
Well, it's a real problem. It's a real life problem. I don't think anybody can lay down rules about what you have to do or don't have to do. You're honest in your own mind about it, but you're not giving an honest answer for very practical reasons. And I don't think we should be replied to in a case like that. Those people don't know what they're saying.
Well, it's a matter of opinion anyway, although we really know the truth, but I mean,
right.
It's a matter of the right to privacy in a way.
Yes, it is, Hope. It fits that very nicely. Ed, you have to handle it.
I don't care. For
what?
For being penalized to find something like
well, it shouldn't be.
And no hesitation at all, they're lying, likely, and no conscience, or anything else. If they want to ask that question, you'd rather ask lies. What do I care?
Yeah.
I'm not talking about license, but I'm talking about job application. Mm. They're not hiring me because I am or I'm not. But how are they hiring the basis of skills I'm presenting to them for sale?
That's true.
And tell me I don't go work for employers, it's how you work for me. I take a chance and I work for them. I don't know what's involved when I go to a new job. They take a chance, I take a chance. And I think it's a gross invasion of my privacy.
I think that may be the main point, that it is an invasion of privacy.
None of employers' business. If we were looking for commercial license where many people were involved, that's a different story. They have to be a scandal about it. But they won't try to lead on to the question of relevance. Who the hell is going to say, who would put yes? No,
thanks. Ross is taking his honesty very seriously, but he took his.
Well, I wasn't drinking, he was just I passed the physical, really didn't have any problem.
He was a guy who was a
I'm just telling one and all of you. Lie.
I don't think I'll even tell that anywhere.
Don't cross your fingers under the desk, or even cross your legs.
Well, it is a matter of opinion, and in the opinion of everybody in this room, including me, I'm an alcoholic, but I'm sure I can find two or three people that don't think I am. So.
Oh, of course you can.
They ain't on the licensing board. You know, the public opinion is so dead against alcohol. That's why those questions. There's no point in trying to argue honestly in the face of mass prejudice. That's what you're up against. You may as well realize that nobody ever got a medal for alcoholism. Nobody was hired because he was anywhere, anytime. I can't even see the situation. I would hire a guy who likely confesses to me that he's an alcoholic, but he's cured the implication. I know he's not cured. Why, televise myself and I don't punish enough, let me put it that way, by myself. I've done enough destruction. I have to continue and look for new groups that I've got enough of that nonsense. My public facilities, my facilities, my own facilities, there's no sense in prolonging.
Well, I have to agree with you, Ed, and I guess most people in the room do. In other words, there's no point in walking the plank without being pushed. Is that all it made you think of? We've still got some time.
Well, I'm an appendix then. Should I say yes or no?
I wouldn't know.
On a bright, still have it.
Did they ever ask that?
You never know what's going to happen from day to day now.
That's my truth.
Do you think that it's possible that you might suggest to me that alcohol is synonymous? I have three very close friends that if you feel the person call me, do you think that's how it's going to be?
Well, I think that would help very much, sure.
You think that would work as well?
Not quite as well, no. But it would be part of the job. It wouldn't be the whole job. See, there's one point that I have made many a time, and I might as well do it now, but it doesn't fit in any particular talk. It would go anywhere. But when you start to think about it, what we have all done, we have educated our subconscious mind into always taking a drink. We're brought up that way. You know, we're brainwashed about drinking. Everybody does it. It's the thing to do. And as a matter of fact, if you don't drink with people, they look kind of askance at you. You know, what's the matter with her? Or what's the matter with him? People don't like to have a non-drinker around when they're drinking. Most of them. If they're close friends and know what you've been through. So, willy-nilly, our subconscious mind has been educated or trained to always say yes to an offer to drink, to reach for a drink, to have a drink, you know, to think about having a drink if it's in certain situations, certain social situations, and in most of our lives are completely tied up to drinking. When you have decided you don't want to drink anymore, you have to do something about that subconscious mind that will make you automatically reach for a drink without thinking.